There's something about doing a lot with a little, which is deeply satisfying to me. And any fool can make a complicated model, but it takes a real genius like Steve DeShazer to come up with a really simple thing that nonetheless is flexible to fit so many situations.
That is Simply Focused with Every Channel and Dominic Goodack for live and joy and deep.
We've got a brand new exciting episode for you. Please welcome your host, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Welcome back to episode number 74 and a joyful hello to Mark McCurgo. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Elfie. Lovely to be with you. I'm Dominic.
It's so great to be here. We're in Edinburgh in a beautiful house of Jenny Clark and Mark McCurgo, and we're spending a lovely time together. We just had lunch and, yeah, we had some interesting discussions about art, and now we're, of course, looking forward to talk to you about solution focus.
And we are really excited. Excited to finally be here with you and to have you on our podcast, because the initial step we planned to have you on the podcast was at the very beginning, and it took quite a while to come here to Edinburgh. So thank you very much for having us here in Edinburgh, and also thank you very much for joining in our conversation.
I'm delighted to join the conversation, absolutely thrilled after all this time. We did record something right at the start, but I think it wasn't good enough quality, possibly from the recording quality or possibly even from the input. Who knows?
No, it definitely and certainly was not the input, but we learned quite a lot meanwhile in recording and editing and, well, guaranteeing good sound quality, basically. So thank you for giving us another chance, Mark.
Mark, you're well known in the Solution Focused community. You're a Solution Focused trainer, you're a speaker, you're a thought leader, you're author. You introduced Solution Focus with the book, The Solutions Focused, together with Paul Sajakson, into the management world. You have come up with so many interesting topics over the years that really inspired me, inspired us, and always made us think and always let us make progress. So I'm very thankful that you've done all this work on your path, and we really would not be here with our Solution Focused practice without you. So thank you very much for that.
So Mark, to start with, what is it that fascinates you about Solution Focused?
I think that's a really interesting question, Elfie, because reflecting on when I started in Solution Focused, 1993 was my first exposure to Solution Focused work. And I could immediately see something that was really interesting about it. There was something about this field that was not like some of the other things that I had looked at, like NLP and systemic change and one or two other things at that point as a young management consultant. I saw something in Solution Focus that made me think, wow, that's really good. I want to do that. And here we are 27 years later, and I'm still doing it. And last week I was at the European Brief Therapy Association summer camp in Germany, which was marvelous, as one of the kind of hosts and I guess one of the experienced people who was sharing ideas with this younger crowd who had come to the camp to learn and be together. And I started reflecting, well, how come I'm here? I'm not a therapist. And I had to learn a bit about how to be a therapist in order to learn solution focus right at the start, because that's all there was. But something has kept me at this field, and I've come in as an outsider. And in a way, I'm still a bit of an outsider, I think, because I'm from the management world. And I have interest in what makes things work and what makes things effective and what makes things help people and what helps people move themselves forward. But there are all sorts of things that help people move themselves forward. Solution focus is not the only way to do that. So what is it that makes it really beautiful? Why is it I still go, oh, that's good, when I see a nice piece of solution focus work? And that's kept me at it for 27 years. And so I have a paper that I've been working on recently and is going to, I hope, appear soon about solution focus as an aesthetic. What makes solution focused work beautiful? And this is something I started thinking about at a meeting in Malmo some years ago. And Harry Corman and Katy Hankowski and Jonas Wells and Stanis Kluter and a number of other people were there. And I just chucked this out as a topic and started to elaborate on it and immediately started to think, wow, this is an interesting way to look at it. Because what makes it beautiful is nothing to do with the techniques, really. There's something more than that. And while different people have tackled this subject since then, this is a very personal write-up. For personal thoughts about what makes it beautiful for me, and that maybe explains why I'm still here after 27 years of, you know, hanging around in the solution focused world and trying to make useful contributions and additions and notices and writings and whatever.
So there are two things I'm super curious now about. So what was this something that you saw at the very beginning that, you know, captured your attention and made you want to know more about it? And then the other thing, of course, what makes solution focus so beautiful for you?
Okay, well, I'll tell you the story about the start. I was on holiday in Spain, in the north of Spain, Cantabria, in the Picos de Europa mountains with Jenny. And we'd only been together about 2 years at the time. And it was one of our first summer holidays together. And I'd run into a guy called James Wilk in London. He was actually doing, I think now, strategic work, not solution-focused. Say more like Jay Haley, but with organizations. What he was doing was different to most of the other people, and I had a chat with him. So the story goes, oh, this is true, that it was a very hot day, and I was wearing a very woolen suit, and we got talking, Wilk and I, after the talk that he gave, and everybody else left, and then I collapsed. Because it was a hot day and I hadn't drunk enough liquor, I just fainted. I actually just fell over. And he was the only person who was left in the room because we'd been talking so long. So he had to revive me, and he called the paramedics, and they came and, you know, gave me the all clear, effectively. And he gave me a lift back to the station and said, you should read my book. And so I got his book, and I was reading it on the balcony of our rental cottage in the Picos de Europa. And I remember going through it and keeping underlining things in pencil and scribbling, yes, 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 exclamation mark in the margin. Because this was so resonating with what was seen to be different. And it's not solution focused in that book as we know it now, but it has some commonalities. And one of them was his difference between a customer and a client. And he says that you want the person in front of you not just to be any old client, but to be someone who wants something. And I underline, yes, 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 yes. And I thought, wow, that's a really good distinction, because normally, as a consultant, a client's a good start and you can make money out of them. And then who cares after that? You know, but this was something more incisive, more direct, more to the point. And there are various other things in the book. And also that book contains, I think, the famous line about if the therapist thinks he or she knows what the client needs to do, they should take two aspirins, lie down until the feeling goes away, which I think is Bill O'Hanlon's line. And of course, that line's come down to us. But I think it appears for the first time in that book. It was Bill's first book, and he now says he would have done it very differently. But I'm glad he did it that way to start with. It's a very heavy and philosophical book. But I was thinking, this is different. This is really, really to the point. And then I came back to London and mentioned this, and somebody said, oh, Bill O'Hanlon's coming to do a seminar at Brief, the Brief Therapy Practice, as it then was. You should go along. And I went along and met there Harry Norman, who lived in Bristol, as I did. And a few weeks later, we set up the Bristol Solutions Group. And that's, you know, that was really how I got started into this field. But then it's an interesting question. That was all 27 years ago. What did I see that really made me so interested to start traveling around the country and then around the world, chasing down people like Steve DeShazer? Because the next conference after that, went to a seminar at Brief and then a seminar in Bristol, and then Jenny and I went off to the joint BFTC MRI conference in California. The MRI being the kind of precursors of solution-focused work with Paul Watzlawick and John Weakland and Dick Fish and their team, who did similar but different work, more problem-focused, about breaking problem patterns. And I thought these joint conferences happened all the time, but it turned out this was the only one. This was the only time, pretty much, when all those people were on a panel together. And Jenny and I were in the audience as complete novices, not almost complete novices. And I just recently published on YouTube some recordings from that conference, which I didn't make. They were commercial recordings made by a company that has long since disappeared. And so I have no problem with sharing them publicly now, but well-made recordings of Stephen Insoo and Paul Watzlawick talking at that conference. Very, very interesting. 25 years ago. And so something made me want to get on aeroplanes to chase this stuff. And I think it is partly this thing about what makes it beautiful. What makes it, for me, such a compelling idea, such a compelling way of working.
And what is it? Well, what is it that you say, well, this is, yeah, what makes solution focused beautiful?
Well, I've always liked this idea of elegance and minimalism. And maybe that comes to me being a physicist in my first part of my career. I always say that now I'm a recovering physicist, which means I take it a day at a time, and it's you're never really better from being a physicist. But there's something about doing a lot with a little. which is deeply satisfying to me. And any fool can make a complicated model, but it takes a real genius like Steve DeShazer to come up with a really simple thing that nonetheless is flexible to fit so many situations. And so when I started to think a little while ago, when I decided I would write this piece, I started to think about what are the things that make solution focus beautiful? What is the aesthetic of solution focus? And I started looking back at the use of this word aesthetic in the art movement, because there people talk about an impressionist aesthetic or a cubist aesthetic or a classical aesthetic. And these are different ways of looking at art. And so just a brief summary. So if we go back to classical period, you look at landscapes by Canaletto, beautiful landscapes of Venice, famously, or English landscapes by Gainsborough. Beautiful, beautiful constructed pictures painted in the studio off a lot of sketches, but with this perfection, this kind of complete perfection of landscape and composition. Absolutely beautiful, and it took months to do. And then people in France started to want to do things a bit more quickly. And these people started to paint outside in a much more impressionistic style, which conveyed the moment. This is not perfectly constructed classical beauty. This was a sense of what it was like to be there. And they worked much more quickly. And therefore, their pictures were kind of not as beautifully done, but they still had an interesting spirit. And one of the pictures was called an impression or something. And it was, who was it? Manet or Monet? I can never remember. and the classical people laughed and they said, ah, look at that. I call that a picture. That's not a picture. That's just a bit of half-done sketching. But the impressionist said, no, it's a picture. Really, it's a picture. And there was a lot of controversy. And the Emperor of France, Napoleon III, saw these pictures, which had been refused from the Grand Exhibition. And he said, no, the people should make their minds up. So they set up this Salon de Refusé, the Salon of the Refused, to show these refused pictures. And many came to laugh, but many came to discover, actually, these were rather good. They were rather admirable, these pictures. And so a new movement was born, and they took the name that they'd been accused of, the Impressionists. It's just an impression. And it became the Impressionists, and a whole movement developed of Impressionist paintings. And of course, these are even more famous these days than the classical painters in some ways. And then the people like Picasso and Braque and their friends, they went through the similar process when they started to do cubism. And again, they were refused from the main exhibition. They set up their own exhibition. And of course, with cubism, if you have a picture of, let's say, a bowl of fruit and a guitar, people in the old Dutch Old Master School paint that beautifully, absolutely, classically, perfectly done. But then Picasso and Braque come along, and now all of a sudden the fruit has corners on it, and the guitar is in 47 pieces, and it's all angles, and because they're trying to show the thing from different angles on a flat surface, a flat canvas. And again, that's impressive, and I love cubist art too. But you can't compare a classical old master of a bowl of fruit to a cubist piece of a bowl of fruit and expect to draw the same things, because they're different aesthetics. And if you look at work in one school with an aesthetic from a different school, of course, it looks unsatisfactory. It looks not beautiful. It looks crazy. And I think this is one of the things, this aesthetic quality is something we almost take for granted in the solution focus. Well, what we think makes it beautiful is not what, it turns out, many of the adherents of other older, longer-term therapy schools think makes their work beautiful. So the comparison between the classical and the impressionist or the cubist is a really good one, because we're doing something that's deliberately different. And if you compare it to the standards of the old thing, of course it looks crazy. But we have our own set of standards and norms and our own aesthetic. And I set out trying to unpack what were the key features of this thing. And I came up, the paper at the moment in its current draft has five. You could make more, but I tried to do five things that I think make solution focus work beautiful and are quite distinctive. And they are...
Drum roll.
Well, I'm going to say them all, because this is the idea of the big picture first and then the detail. I'm going to say all five and then I'll go and unpack them. So the five things are, first of all, brevity. It's brief therapy, right? The second thing is client autonomy. The client gets to choose. The third thing is radical acceptance. And that kind of goes with client autonomy in a way, but it's now the therapist engaging with the client's autonomy. And the fourth thing is staying at the surface, which kind of goes with radical acceptance as well. And the fifth thing is the value of small differences. Mm-hmm. And I think that each of those things brings something to this work that you don't find in many other fields. And for me, those are the five things that make it really beautiful.
Yeah, and I can imagine that most of those five, when they are viewed from a different perspective, from another model or other therapeutic background, it's, what are they doing?
Like, yes, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So you compare it with, you know, the sort of classical psychoanalytical type of thing, and there longer is better, and we think shorter is better. There it's about, not really about client autonomy, it's about, I fear, practitioner dominance sometimes. The practitioner has to teach the client the language of their thing, their sort of way of working. It's not about radical acceptance, it's about getting your client to accept what you think, which is why it takes years. It's very painful. It's not about saying the surface, it's about delving into the depths. And finally, small differences are almost irrelevant, because it's a big problem, you need a big difference. So this looks a bit like, to me, the impressionist being judged by the standards of the classical. You know, our standards and ideas and aesthetics are not the same. So let me just unpack those five things a little bit. First of all, brevity. Now, this is solution-focused brief therapy, right? Solution-focused brief practice. And the clue is in the title. And that's one of the things I love. Having been a consultant who, you know, got paid by the hour, in a way, things that take a long time are a good thing, but they're not respectful of your clients. I don't mind being tied up for hours, but why should I expect the people I'm working with to want to be tied up for hours and weeks and months and years if there's a short thing they can do that will help them kind of move on and get to the next stage? And maybe that's another thing that's worth talking about here. By brief, we mean brief to get people moving under their own steam again. It doesn't say their whole lives are sorted, but it's enough for them to tackle it under their own steam, and that's a normal state of affairs. We all tackle our lives under our own steam, and we have ups and downs, and we don't claim to be able to give you a life with no downs. That would be nuts. But what we do is help people to the next stage as quickly as reasonably practical, and that can be one session. And it's the idea every session could be the last. You know, the choice is in the client's hands, whether to come back and perhaps when. That's another good thing. When do you want to come back? Next week? Or maybe it's 3 weeks, or maybe it's a month. So this idea of brevity brings of itself a really interesting aesthetic. This is the start of us handing control to our clients. And your client is the one who decides when they want to come back, along with all sorts of other things, which we'll come to in a minute. So in a way, we're handing a lot of power to our clients. Now, of course, we never completely lose our influence and power in this, but we're deliberately handing it over and trusting our clients in the first instance.
Reminds me of a client that just heard about the other day, who came to a therapist with suicidal thoughts. And after one or two sessions, she went out, and now she's too busy to come back. And everything is kind of going in a good direction. So kind of really...
Yes, that's it. She doesn't need it anymore. She's not without problems, I would be fairly sure. But she doesn't need this help anymore. And if she does, she can probably ring up and make another appointment. But that's enough for us. So first of all, it's not simply effectiveness. All sorts of practices are effective in terms of do they work. But the question that all these studies of Wompold and all those people don't look at is how long did it take? And for me, this is a great hole in all of that research, because if it works but it takes a year, then that's not as good for me as it works but it takes 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And in that, so assuming you have a limit of practitioners, practitioners have a limited resource, then the difference between a year and 3 weeks is the practitioner could have seen 17 clients in the year instead of one. That's 16 more people you've helped. Now, that's good for my money. That's worth having. So brevity is important. And then the second thing was client autonomy. We already started talking about that, because the client gets to decide when they've finished. But the client also gets to decide their hopes, their day after the miracle, where they are now on the scale, and all sorts of things. We are really not trying to teach our clients how to live their lives. They are doing this for themselves. And yes, we ask questions and we encourage them along to answer them. But we don't want to tell our clients what to do. And I observe people who write about these things say, of course, in the end, if somebody appears to be unsafe or there's a child involved who is unsafe, you have to intervene. That's part of being a responsible member of society. And of course, we have to bear that possibility into account. But when we do that, I'm going, that's not really good, is it? You know, the really good times are when the client sort of seizes their autonomy and uses it and does something. So just as long therapy, occasionally solution-focused work can take a long time, occasionally. But that's not the really beautiful stuff. That's a bit, for me, it's a bit second class. And likewise, if we have to intervene and try and help people be safe, we have to do it. But again, it's not really what I'm here for. I'm here to get the client taking their autonomy and doing something great with it on their own terms. And I want to applaud that and encourage them along that direction. And it sets this field apart from many, many others, this real focus on client autonomy. And I don't have to think I'm trying to change your thoughts, you know, like a CBTer. I'm not trying to change your thoughts. I'm just simply wanting you to talk about what you want in these various ways that we have. And so in a way, but that also means I don't need to be the expert in that. I'm the expert in nudging your conversation along. So it opens up all kinds of this new way of working. Client autonomy, with the client making the decisions and the client calling the shots. Again, for me, that's beautiful. So the third thing, which follows on from that, is Steve Chase's idea of radical acceptance. And I think this is under-talked about, under-discussed, radical acceptance. So your client says something, and you accept it, and you don't argue with it. And that's how Steve puts it in his early writings on this. Don't argue with your client. And John Weakland, Steve's mentor from the MRI, said the same thing. Don't argue with your client. Now, your client can say something which is surprising and perturbing and so on, and not arguing with it doesn't necessarily mean accepting it completely and that's the end of the story, because there's always more to say. So we accept it and we do a yes and move, and we find a question that comes back about it. And one of my little mottos is change is happening all the time. And the fact that the client says something at minute 3 doesn't mean that by minute 7 they won't be saying something else. So not to get too hung up on it. But don't argue with people. So that then brings a whole range of elegant, almost balletic manoeuvres, where how do you accept something and get the conversation going in a way that gets the client to develop their thinking on it without arguing with them? And there's lots of elegance. I'm reminded sometimes of really good footballers who can sort of jink one way and go the other way. And this is a little bit like that, or you know, the famous nutmeg move where you kick the ball through the opposition's legs and then run round them and carry on. But there's a great skill in this. Hearing your client say something that's really kind of maybe disturbing. Oh, sometimes I want to kill myself. You know, and you don't argue with it. And our natural response, the human response, is to say, oh no, please don't. That's arguing with it. But there are so many more ways to work with it. And so it's exploring those that I think is really interesting, because you're encouraging your client to think, and you're encouraging your client to be creative, and you're encouraging your client to, you know, perhaps see different angles on this thing without arguing with them.
And isn't it great that they always have good reasons for that? And also, yes, as soon as you start asking about differences, for example, what great answers you hear. And I always have this example, the comparison between positive psychology and solution focus. Like when people say, well, positive psychology, we want to be happy, or people want to be happy. And in solution focus, we don't aim for people to be happy. If someone comes and said, I want to be sad, for example, we could say, well, what difference would that make? And the person might say, well, you know, I cannot feel my emotions, and feeling sad would really, kind of connect me to my emotions again, and I would really feel as a whole person again, or something like that. So we would go with an answer like that. And what we realize always when we do that is, as soon as we start asking about differences, how you see the good reasons, how elaborate the answers are that come, and that at the end of the conversation, you're at a completely different point.
Absolutely. Yeah. Things move on in such a rapid way sometimes. But as soon as you start arguing, you're setting up a yes, it is, no, it isn't. And it's hard to get out of that once you begin it. And it's so easy to unwittingly start it. So I think it's a great skill in this, how do we accept what our clients say and yet keep moving, keep talking about it, because things do change and things do move and things become clearer and all sorts of things happen.
So what is an example out of your solution focused practice where you did kind of a Lionel Messi move?
I'm no Lionel Messi, let me assure you and all the listeners of that. I'm thinking about you get these from time to time. Well, I work in organizations, and so people often come to say, you know, if they're being outsourced, made redundant. And so you end up coaching those people sometimes, because it's part of the service that companies, the good companies, offer. They get some help in various ways, and that can be financial and it can be involved some coaching. And I've done that sort of coaching. And people come in, often they're shocked, they're sad, they're confused. This company that they invested so much of their life in is kind of saying, no, actually, thanks, we don't need you anymore. That's a horrible thing to to have happen to you. And you sit down, and occasionally people will say things really quite striking. Well, I have no idea what to do. And of course, you don't say, well, I bet you have. It's arguing. You know, and so you go slowly, and in that situation, and you say, oof, must be tough. And they go, yeah. And there's this long pause. And I personally don't like to be the first one to break that pause. I like to wait. And that can mean my own tactic is sitting very still and looking somewhat expectant and really not moving. Because as soon as you start to even begin to move, it's sort of your go again. And I want it to be their go. Often something comes, oh, maybe I'll have to go back to doing X, Y, Z. I have to go back to being an accountant. There's all sorts of ways you can go with that. Oh, do you used to be an accountant? Well, do you want to be an accountant again? What else might you go back to, as well as being an accountant? And none of this is arguing with your client, but it's all opening up that possibility space. Mm-hmm. And so I'm delighted to say that in my line of work, I don't get people offering to kill themselves or anything. At least not seriously. But the challenge is the same. And you make the client do the work. And one of my little things I always teach people is don't work harder than your client. If you're working harder than your client, something's going wrong somewhere. And often that's because we haven't accepted. We're trying to push back. And of course, when you push back, client will push back. And then you get into a thing where you're suddenly working very hard. And so this, I'd like to see more taught and done and trained and used in this idea, because it's always been there. I think it's always been there in this approach, but it's particularly valued in solution focused work. It's almost like the sort of using in martial arts, they talk about using your client's energy against them. I'm not saying it's against them, but I want to channel it back for them. And if they're really unhappy about something, there's some energy. And we're going to, it's interesting to see where that's going to go next. But it's not going to be there from me popping up and arguing with them or making clever suggestions or whatever. It's going to be there by me offering them the mirror of channeling it back.
I think it's always been there, but you're making it explicit now. And there's a focus that we can really focus on in trainings, for example, because as you said, I see it in the same way, that maybe something that's been understated or not made explicit enough, or could be made more explicit to focus on and learn from even more. Yeah, so what's number four?
Well, number four is, again, builds on this, is the idea of staying at the surface. Now, this is a phrase that we use quite a lot, but it's really interesting that not many other aesthetics have this. In fact, they have the contrary aesthetic, which is where you should try and be very clever, and you should, rather than just taking what the client says seriously, you should read between the lines. You should look deep into them. You should try and see the real problems and the real issues and the real emotions that are all alleged to be bubbling away there behind the scenes. And I love the way that solution focus is we stay at the surface and you take what the client says seriously. And that's it. And then you see what happens. And again, this is all about maybe respect. Respect is connecting these things about client autonomy, radical acceptance, and staying at the surface. It's all about respect. It's all about respecting your client as a human being who has a right to live their life within the law, I suppose, in a way that they want to.
The brief part as well for me, because this is a very respectful thought towards a client or a customer, to make it as brief as possible for them.
Yes, and not take up their lives with endless treatment that they don't need and can't afford. So staying at the surface, again, it's the same sort of thing. If somebody says something, you don't try and be clever. You just, you know, use it or not. You overlook it. The conversation keeps going. It cuts away all this false metaphors of hydraulic feelings being repressed in one place and then bursting out in another place, as if there's some kind of leaking waterbed happening inside people or their brains or something. And we're not looking for mechanisms systems inside the person. We're not looking, what are really her feelings? What is really his motivation? What is really driving her here? Those are questions for other people. This is not what we do. And I think that adds up to, again, huge respect. Huge respect that the person is the one who's doing it, and they are a person, and they are free in that sense, something we discussed at the EBTA summer camp last week. And a free person can take that freedom for themselves. And in a way, we're almost demanding that they do that with our questions. What are your best hopes? It's not what are your boss's best hopes, or what are your wife's best hopes, or what's your mother's best hopes, or what's your teacher's best hopes. It's what are your best hopes? That's the start. Now, the wife or the boss or the teacher may come into the picture as we go along, and that might be interesting too. But that's not the beginning. You are free. And I am almost demanding that you take your freedom.
Yeah.
And this is a set of ideas I'm still working on from some discussions we had last week. But I'm kind of think this is, it's an interesting tie in there. All this stuff about client respect and autonomy is not just us offering freedom. You can't offer freedom, but it's demanding that you take it. And that's quite strong words. There's a strong way of talking. It's a stronger way of talking than we often do. Because SF people are typically very gentle and very, because we work in what looks like a gentle way. But I think it's actually a very profound way, and it can sometimes be very tough. And you can keep asking people questions which effectively demand they take their freedom, and when they refuse, you ask them again. You know, anyone who's watched Chris Iveson work will have seen this kind of practice in action. He says, well, what would it be the first sign after the day after the miracle? I don't know. I have the faintest idea. Well, what time would you wake up? I really don't know. How do you expect me to answer this? Well, it's a tough question, admittedly. What time would you wake up? Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. And it's not about the wimpily letting people off. It's holding them in this space where they can take their freedom.
I think this is also very, very relevant for leadership where you're deeply into. So when we work with leaders, we often hear things like, oh, it's really hard for my employees to take this freedom and to start to think, and because they're not used to it. Our culture is not like that. And there are a lot of excuses for leaders and also for their employees for not stepping into this freedom or for not use this freedom to start to think for themselves. Themselves and for the organization in a very different way, namely from the point of their view and share their voice, and well, by that also maybe make them vulnerable and well, expose themselves somehow, but yet make a true contribution to the field where they are.
Yes, and so I've written quite a lot over the last 5 years or so about the leader as a host, the host, the one who brings people together in a good way around some sort of issue or problem or topic that affects everybody. And it's in the way you bring people together that the leader can act. And that is not like the leader telling people what to do, but it's the leader setting up the conditions, the context, the connections, the boundaries to have those conversations. Now, in actual leadership, the leader is a player as well. The leader is taking up a facilitative role, kind of, in bringing people together, but then they're also a player. So that means it's not facilitative. And I'm just working on a piece at the moment about how hosting and facilitation are different. And this is a piece in conjunction with Gervase Bush, who has worked on dialogic OD and wrote a very good book about dialogic organization development, in which he lists solution focus as one of the 37 identified known ways of doing dialogic work in organizations. And I'm very happy that he does actually include SF in that list. Many other people don't in the other lists of dialogic ways of working with organizations. So hosting is not facilitation, but it has facilitative aspects to it about bringing people together. And the leader, of course, has an influence on what gets decided, but a good host will let people talk and only kind of nudge them if it's really, really necessary. And if you have to nudge them late in the process, you didn't set the conditions up well enough at the start, I think. So there's a great skill in that. And we're working on a host leadership field book at the moment, which will be the third host leadership book, one in English by me and Helen Bailey, one in French by Laurent Sarrazin and Jerry Derbier. And this, I think, will be the third book with lots of contributions from different people about how they're using host leadership. So I think that it does tie in very well. People have their autonomy, but the host sets a context within which they have their autonomy.
And it demands that they also act. in this context. It doesn't demand the way, but it demands that they do something in the context, use it somehow. So if you're in a party and you're just, nobody's contributing to the party, there will be no party.
That's right. And that's one of the host's roles, is to encourage people to get things moving and start things off and go first and encourage people to join in and notice if anyone's hanging around on the edge and needs to be kind of encouraged a bit more to join in and so forth. Maybe they have concerns and those concerns need to be listened to. So lots and so many aspects of being a host. So thank you, Elfie, for bringing that in, because this idea of people taking their autonomy, and yet we always do it within a context. We always have our freedom within a context. And one of my favorite all-time quotes, which is not an SF quote, was Stephen Rose, an evolutionary biologist, from his book Lifelines, talking about how we're not determined by our DNA. One of the many things that doesn't determine us, it sets constraints on us, maybe, but it doesn't determine us. And he says, slightly paraphrasing Karl Marx, that we create our own futures, but not in circumstances of our own choosing. And for me, this gives the balance and the tension that's always there in life. Yes, you have freedom, but there's other things going on as well that you may not have control over. You probably don't. And I think, you know, we're straight with our clients in a way, then that's what we can try and do for them. And we're working within that envelope. And I know some, you know, very good friends in the American self-help movement, and they're kind of a bit more gung-ho about, you can do whatever you want, you can have it all. And I think, really? Honestly? So I think we're more realistic on that front. And the final thing, the fifth thing, was about valuing the small differences. And this is a slightly different quality, perhaps, than the other ones. But nonetheless, was immediately one of the things that got me into SF, was this idea that a small difference can be amplified, or it can be a sign of something interesting that needs to be investigated and expanded and can be built. And I had an experience very, very early on. I was coaching somebody who was a manager in a library, and she said, bemoaning of her team not doing the thing that she was hoping they would do. And I said, well, when do they do it? And she said, they hardly ever do it. And even I, in my beginner's state of solution focus, realized there's a difference between they never do it and they hardly ever do it. And what hardly ever means is they do it occasionally. And so, of course, I started pursuing, so they hardly ever do it. Well, what happens when they do? And about 2 minutes later, she ended the coaching session saying she knew exactly what she needed to do. Thank you very much. And that was it. Unfortunately, I'd never asked her what it was. I wish I had. It would have been a much better story. But these tiny, tiny, tiny things that look so small, they're valuable because they offer a difference that can be built on. And they offer a sort of a sign that change is possible and indeed inevitable. And they offer a sign that the client has more control in their lives sometimes than they thought. And this, you know, you can make small differences to your life, and that maybe that means you can make bigger differences. And but we never say that, but that's kind of how we're going on in this thing.
And this reminds me of a great talk you gave about changes happening all the time and how we amplify useful change. And you explained that so brilliantly. We will put that in the resource section of this podcast for people to listen to. I think this is a very, very inspiring talk and everyone should listen to. So I just would love to mention it here.
Yeah. So the point about the idea of change happening all the time is not to say, that, of course, that everything is changing all the time. It's not. The world would be chaos if that was the case. But it's just to remind us that there's always the possibility of difference. So even if today feels an awful lot like yesterday, there's a possibility of difference. And if there's a possibility of difference, we should look for it and ask about it and seek it. And if we don't think change is happening all the time, we take too easily that it hasn't happened. Whereas if we assume change is happening all the time, then there's always a good reason to look for tiny, tiny differences.
And if you look for them, you'll find them too.
Well, very, very often. That's right. That's right. And your client will, you know, ask the right sort of questions. We'll start to find those small differences, and then we'll begin to notice more small differences, and it all starts to snowball. Very interesting.
And I love the way how you suggest that this noticing of those tiny differences, if I got you correctly, that those often lead us to our preferred future.
In that direction. And of course, we're playing with the past, the present and the future in a solution focused conversation. So we've got the preferred future type discussion about the things you would notice day after miracle. But we've also got things that you're noticing right now on a scale. And you've got things you noticed in the past when things were a bit better or slightly less bad or something like that. The instances, as we're starting to call them now, the instances of the preferred future happening already. And it's in the detail. This is something it took me a little while to figure out, because as a physicist, it's in the principles, but in people's lives, it's in the detail. And the more detail we dig into, and that's small detail, the more it becomes actionable and the more it becomes real. And that is such a different way of working than thinking, oh, a big problem needs a big solution, which is kind of the standard way of looking at things.
Oh, and that so well brings us back to the beginning of our conversation. And I would love to hear from you, maybe if there is one thing from this conversation that you would really love people to take with them. What would this one thing be?
I think based on this conversation, it's to look for this idea of radical acceptance. Mm. And look for, not only if you're a practitioner, if you're a therapist or a coach or whatever, how can you really do a bit more of that? And even if you're just somebody living an everyday life and you want to do it in a bit more solution-focused way, how can you not argue with people? Mm. You know, there's an irony here, because I love arguing with people. And it's something I learn and I struggle with and so on. And in a way, you know, when I'm not got my work hat on, I do argue with people. And I think that's all right. I think that's part of being a human. But if I've got my work hat on, then I can sort of shift modes. And sometimes I need to radically accept what people say without my work hat on a little bit more, and my life would be a bit better. And maybe theirs would as well.
Thank you very much for sharing your aesthetics of solution focus. And I know that many people will share those aesthetics too. So we're, of course, curious what the people will say and what was especially useful in this podcast. But before we come to that, let's come to the challenge of the week.
So the challenge of the week for this week is notice a time when you'd like to argue with someone and find another way of continuing the conversation. Which can be asking a question, or it can be making a noise, or it could be nodding and going, uh-huh. Or it could be sort of asking for more details, or it could be just, you know, one of the classic, what difference would that make? But find another way of not arguing, because I think that's, in a way, we've got into an arguey place in the world at the moment in all kinds of ways. And one of our skills as solution-focused people is supposed to be in this. You cannot not argue with someone and yet not accept what they say. Either. You know, the way we accept it, you're not accepting it as if it was the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So you can accept it and continue to build on it, explore it, and so on. So that's a good challenge. You find a time when you would like to argue with someone and find another way to respond.
Thank you, Mark. I already have someone in mind with whom I could try that out, and I'm not looking at Mark right now.
So thank you for making the next week even a better week, and we'll share with you what worked especially well in not arguing and doing something else. And please do that too. Share with us in the comment section of our podcast. Go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 74.
And please share with us what inspired you in our conversation with Mark. We are very curious to hear more about that. And please share, because the things that inspire you might also inspire someone else and keep on going their solution-focused journey. So we are very much looking forward to hearing from you. And we say once again a big thank you, Mark, for giving us a second chance to have this conversation.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be with you again.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Wow, what a great episode again. Do you like the Simply Focus podcast? Well, help Elfie and Dominic spread the word. Give the Simply Focus podcast an excellent rating on iTunes and Google Play and other platforms. This was the Simply Focus podcast with Elfie Cherney and Dominic Odat, your podcast for a life in joy and ease.